You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm delighted to introduce my next guest. In fact, I'm honoured, and I don't use that word lightly. His name is Professor Nigel Bigger. He's the Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at the University of Oxford. He's an ethicist, a theologian, an Anglican priest, and I could actually go on listing an array of activities, but he's also an author. So, Professor Bigger, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. I've been in New Zealand about 24 hours, and I'm enjoying it so far.
Well, welcome to New Zealand as well. It's wonderful to have you down here. I was saying before we came on air, I hope that the Free Speech Union here, who have brought you across, give you some time off to see our beautiful country.
I hope so too.
Now, you're obviously down here for free speech. You are the chair of the Free Speech Union in the United Kingdom, and as I say, an esteemed academic out of the University of Oxford, nonetheless. But one of the critical linch points in your career of late, and if I might be presumptuous, which has led you even further into the free speech side, is that you wrote a book about a year ago entitled Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning. So I wonder if we could start there and give listeners a bit of a hint about what this book is and then why it set the cat amongst the pigeons.
Yes, Simon. So the book is designed to attempt a moral and ethical assessment of colonialism, and it focuses on British colonial empire in particular, because that's the empire, that's the colonialism that is the focus of a lot of heated controversy, not only in New Zealand, also in Australia, Canada, and Britain, and even to some extent in the United States. And the reason why, I mean, empire, those of you who know history will know that empire is a universal form of political organization. Most people in history have been ruled under empires. So why focus on the British? Well, I think the focus is because the British Empire is a proxy for the West. And this is an attack on the record of the West. And although I'm pro-Western, of course, those of us who live in the West have different views of what's valuable in the West. We can talk about that, we can quarrel about that. But the attack on the West is indiscriminate and wholesale. And at a time when liberal Western democracies in your country and mine are under a threat from the likes of Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, this is not the time for those of us in the West to lose all of our self-confidence. And it was particularly the worry that by exaggerating the sins of our colonial past, we would undermine our self-confidence and give succor to enemies in Beijing and Moscow. That's really why I came to write this book. And so the book is not a history book. It addresses moral questions head on. Was the empire essentially racist? Was it always given to indiscriminate violence? It wasn't democratic until right at the end. Did that make it illegitimate? Those kind of questions. And I come up with a nuanced answer. I say, well, the British Empire over its 400-year career, yes, of course it involved bad things. It also involved good things. And in that respect, it's no different from any other long-standing state. And I then argue, in fact, that humanitarian and liberal streams in the empire grew and they came to dominate. So that's in a nutshell, that is what the book says. And yes, I got into trouble because of my views. Even before the book was published, there was an attempt to cancel a research project I ran in 2017. That failed. But then there was another attempt by junior members of Bloomsbury Publishing, which had contracted me to write the book, to derail the book because they refused to work on material they regarded as offensive. So Bloomsbury, in fact, cancelled my contract. Happily, William Collins took it up and the book was published in hardback last year and paperback this year.
You use the word nuance, which I would expect in academia, that there's very little, says me to you, a professor of moral theology, there's very little black and white in life, there's always a lot of nuance. But when it comes to this question of colonialism, and we've certainly had it down here, Professor, in New Zealand, that colonialism, bad. There's just no good, nothing redeeming. Where, of course, there is more nuance. And yet society seems unable to accept that, as you say. Some others in academia, book publishers, those in media. Why is it? Is it really this absolute, I'm going to use a word hatred here, I don't often like using it, but a hatred of the West and what it stands for, that they can't allow any nuance or subtlety?
Yes, I think that's a very good question, Simon. I think our rather sort of stark, cartoonish view of the colonial past owes a lot to radical black politics in the United States, because anti-racist groups in Britain, and I think even advocates for Aborigines in Australia, and I quite probably, I don't know this, some Maori activists have drunk deep at the well of radical black politics in the United States. And so they see the world in terms of, literally in terms of black versus white. And for political reasons, it is convenient for them to belabor white sin, to glide over the fact that actually non-white peoples are perfectly capable of doing just as badly as white people. Because a lot of those of us who are white Caucasian, we're liberal, we've been educated in heavily progressive universities, and we are inclined to feel guilty. And other parties, including the Chinese, know that, and they want to exploit it, and we are exploitable. What is distressing is that there are people in charge of our institutions who are presumably intelligent and should be well-read and should know that the exaggerated tale, the notion that our colonial histories are nothing but a litany of oppression and racism and exploitation, they must know that's not true. And yet they yield, partly because, I guess, careers depend on it, partly because no one likes to be labeled a racist, and the cultural left are very aggressive and very unfair and very defamatory. And people don't want to attract that kind of aggression. But the problem is it means lies and distortions reign among us, and they shape and misshape public policy.
Possibly is a moral question. One of the things I've found with lies in life is that they have to become more absurd in order to be maintained. And I would probably make the argument, again, I feel quite inadequate in front of a rageous professor here, but once people do start lying, it has to get more and more absurd to protect itself. And it doesn't tend to end very well when one looks through histories. It tends to implode upon itself. Is this a concern that you might have as you look at these, a blinkeredness in our history, yeah, be it around colonialism, slavery, whatever, that it is eventually going to implode in on itself in the West?
Yeah, so I've never articulated that quite as you have now, Simon, but it's a really excellent point. And it's not a concern, it's a ground of hope, because the more, I mean, I'm not a professional historian, although my first degree was in history and my first love is history, and I've read British imperial history over 30 years. But when I first started talking about these things, I was very, very vulnerable to criticism from professional historians who wanted to say, Bigger hasn't read this, he hasn't read that. Bigger isn't a professional, don't listen to him. That was 7 years ago. But I've been in this fight for 7 years. I published a book, and in the paperback edition that came out in March of this year, I added a 70-page postscript in which I answered my 10 most hostile critics. And I'm pretty confident, Simon, and there are lots of historians who have commended my book. I'm pretty confident I got it right. And therefore, the more I've looked at what some of the more unhinged, the more zealous historians and advocates say, the more absurd what they say appears. And I think one reason I'm not despairing about the situation is that the more we examine what's being said. And the more people like me stand up and say no, and here are the reasons why no, the more those little emperors appear naked. So over time, I'm hopeful actually that common sense will reassert itself. And I'm quite sure that most people in my own country and in yours too, who don't know a lot about colonial history, but who don't are not convinced by the highly biased presentation of colonial history, if they get more courage and start to voice their doubts, the landscape could change quite quickly.
Well, says me, I think a big part of it is often it needs people to lead the way. My experience in life is that you need those leaders, and you're one of them who is actually prepared to stand up, take the flak, as awful as it is, but that gives courage to others to do the same. I mean, before we move on to sort of the free speech angle, I mean, and we could speak literally for hours around colonialism. You said near the start, there's so much and almost an obsessive focus with British imperialism, but empires have existed for millennia. Roman, Mongol, Chinese, Arabic. I mean, empire is not unusual, nor is notions like colonization. It's more of a recent word, but again, people taking over. Slavery, these are not uniquely British experiences, are they?
No, of course not. And it is one of the distorting features of current discussion of these things that European and British colonialism is taken completely out of context. And it's taken out of context for political reasons, because if you want to exaggerate white guilt, then you want to avert your eyes from the fact that empire was practiced by people in every continent and people of every skin color. So in the 1600s in North America, the Iroquois Native Americans expanded northwards. They dominated the Huron, who were displaced, and they moved westwards, and their westward movement caused other Native American peoples to flee westward. And by the way, the Huron had the Iroquois had a quaint manner of assimilating those they subjugated. They adopted the women and children, and they tortured and ate the men. So, you know, there are different forms of assimilation. And then in the 1700s, the Comanche in what's now the southwest of the United States overwhelmed the Apache and created what one historian calls a vast slave economy. In the 1800s, the Zulu in South Africa expanded violently westward, displacing other African peoples to three of the four winds in what is now referred to as the Mfukane, the crushing. And finally, I'd mention when the Maori invaded the Chatham Islands in 1835, they didn't make treaties. They slaughtered 10% of the Moriori population and enslaved the rest. When we're considering what white people did in these parts in the 1800s, that's the context.
And says me, I think that context is always important. Again, speaking to a moral theologian, it doesn't justify, but it actually shows that it's not a unique experience to one people. In fact, again, says me, it's a particularly human element. But you've touched a couple of times on this political element, a lot of this decolonizing narrative, the inability to even discuss nuance has linked to arguably a political agenda. And I know you've spoken of late about how this guilt is being used effectively to, generate guilt in people, which makes them feel that they and consequently their society and institutions don't have value. And therefore, there's something quite destructive in this. And it's a fertile ground for sort of revolutionary thinking. I think you've referenced that as well. I mean, is it being successful? Are you seeing in the UK and your very early observations in New Zealand and Australia that lack of confidence in our, what I would suggest, pretty amazing institutions overall?
Yes, well, there's a domestic problem and an international problem. And I think when whites are fingered for being guilty of what they did to non-whites in the past, it makes it very difficult for white people not to yield to what certain non-white people demand. Now, of course, non-white people, like white people, don't all think the same thing, although the way that some of their advocates behave is as if They represent the whole of non-whitedom, which is absurd. But I've seen certainly seen cases where a decent, liberal, irenic, peacemaking white people find it impossible to contradict a black man when he speaks. And that sometimes means that they and their institutions embark on policies that are damaging, not least to race relations, because the stark opposition of white and black creates a race consciousness that 20, 30 years ago, we were taught to try and transcend and get over. So we treat each other as individuals, not as representatives of groups. So I think in a serious way, some of this assertion of cultural identity, racial identity, is actually leading us backward in terms of race relations. But then we've also got the external or international dimension as well. And I think I can't prove this, but I think that the decision of our new foreign secretary in Britain to surrender the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, an ally of China, was no doubt partly influenced by his assumption that because the Chagos Islands were acquired during the colonial period, although I think in fact they were vacant, never mind, it's because they were acquired during the colonial period, they must have been acquired illegitimately. And I've been away since it happened, and I really haven't had the stomach to look exactly what he said, but I think our Prime Minister Keir Starmer has conceded something in the way of reparations for slavery 200 years ago, which I myself think is absurd. If I'm right, then white guilt means that white prime ministers, when pressed by non-white people for money, can't say no because of guilt. I should just add, I often refer to a book by a Baghdad-born Jewish historian, Eli Kaduri, who was discussing in a book he published in 1976 called The Anglo-Arab Labyrinth, discussing whether the British had betrayed the Arabs in allowing Zionists to come into Palestine in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And he himself concluded, no, the British hadn't betrayed the Arabs, but he said that the British Foreign Office believed that the British, had betrayed the Arabs. Therefore, their policy was subject to what he called the canker of imaginary guilt. And it's that canker of imaginary guilt I worry about distorting our domestic and foreign policies.
Well, I have to say, as a former chair of our Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee, I was aghast if I was to step into UK politics of the decision around the Chagos Islands. As I say, I have no doubt that Beijing is having a great laugh at the West's expense. I do, though, have to ask you effectively a philosophical or moral question, because we've talked a lot about guilt. Is there a place for guilt? I mean, is this one of those moments where a little bit of guilt is appropriate, but it's been exploited by the political purposes to make it too much? In other words, is guilt a bad thing? I'm not saying the excessive guilt that's been generated, but is some guilt okay?
When I first started talking about these things 7 years ago, Simon, I wrote an article, in fact, in the London Times, arguing that we British, you New Zealanders, we can look at our colonial history and find cause for both pride and shame. Afterwards, someone said to me, well, you know, we didn't do it. I mean, this was whatever happened in 1800 or 1850, no one alive did it. And so actually, I started talking less in terms of pride and shame or guilt, than in terms of admiration for what our ancestors sometimes did and lamentation at the wrong things they did. So I think guilt's probably not appropriate because we're not directly culpable, we're not directly responsible. But lamentation of things that our ancestors did in the past may well be appropriate. And we need to be honest about the past. It wasn't sin-free any more than we are sin-free. What we do about the wrongdoings of our ancestors is a difficult problem. I mean, just to take the case of slavery, yes, for 150 years, some Britons were involved in profiting from slave trading and slavery. And it's now said that we need to cough up and compensate the descendants of slaves. But the point is that in 200 years, an awful lot else has happened including 150 years of British anti-imperial endeavour worldwide from Brazil to New Zealand. So how one sorts out the sins of the past is a difficult question. My tendency is to think we can't undo the past. What we can do is address problems that manifest themselves in the present. If Australian Aboriginal people or Maori people are suffering in terms of, or disadvantaged in terms of outcomes, education, employment, we need to address those problems. To what extent they are caused by what happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago is quite difficult to determine, because all sorts of other causes have come in. So let's address the proximate, the near causes, not the ones far in the past.
Yeah, I've often found in my reflection of life that it's often easier for people to reflect and make a song and dance, for want of a better phrase, about the past rather than the proximate. It's an easy excuse. I've often seen it too, particularly in some of the young ones, that it's easier to worry about the bigger issues of the world rather than the immediate problems in front of them.
Can I give an illustration of that?
Please.
2015-16 in Oxford, several hundred protesters, mostly students, mostly postgraduate students, were protesting, clamouring for the dismantling of a statue to Cecil Rhodes, who died in 1902 and was a buccaneering, convinced British imperialist, made a lot of money, cut corners, etc. And the students were telling us that that Cecil Rhodes was South Africa's Hitler, which is historical nonsense, but never mind. But then they were clamoring for the dismantling of this statue, and some of them were Rhodes scholars, biting the hand that had fed them, and they weren't particularly keen to lose the title Rhodes scholar. So there they were in Oxford, clamoring for the dismantling of this extremely obscure statue. You have to crane your neck to see it, to be offended by it. Meanwhile, in South Africa, Jacob Zuma and the ANC are looting this African state and driving it to the point of insolvency. And about that real time political scandal in South Africa, now, what are the protesters to say? Absolutely nothing. So it did make me begin to wonder, what is this really about? Who are they? Whose side are they on? Is this really about the poor and oppressed? Or is it about the crusading egos of the crusaders? I'm inclined to think it's the latter.
Well, one of the observations I have with this sort of approach that's being taken is, again, an attack and undermining of our institutions. And for all the failures of the West, our liberal democracy, rule of law, our court system, our elections, basically universal suffrage, these are really positive things, and doubly so when I compare them to, I don't know, Iran, communist China, Russia, and so forth. But I suppose the question then is, with all those who want to dismantle the West, what do they have in mind? Have you come across in any of your work or research or discussions, what is this utopia which decolonizers and others believe is coming? I don't see the alternative laying my cards on the table other than something much worse.
No, Simon, you're right. That's another good point. Just first of all, it's not a coincidence that New Zealand and Australia and Britain and Canada and the United States are among the most liberal countries on earth. Free press, independent judiciary, on the whole, a pretty civil service that is of high probity. The accountability of governments to the electorate, etc. And you're right, those liberal institutions do not exist in China or Russia or Iran or North Korea. And the fact that they exist in all these English-speaking countries is not a coincidence, because the British Empire exported them, and not every country has them. And just one other point with regard to the British imperial liberal tradition. According to the World Values Survey of 2023, surveying, I think, roughly 30 countries worldwide. Australia, Canada, and Britain, I'm afraid New Zealand doesn't appear, but I'm sure it would appear in the same ranking. Australia, Canada, and Britain are among the least racist countries on earth. Right? Roughly 4%, 4%, 2%, depending on which question we're answering. In stark contrast to the likes of China, Iran, and Russia, which sometimes hit 30% or 18% in terms of racist attitudes. And again, it's not a coincidence that there is a strong liberal tradition that has come to prevail among us, and long may it do so. So some, whatever one thinks about the sins of the colonial past, there were also important liberal institutions that were built, institutions so liberal that they have enabled us to begin to discuss how to correct or make up for the bad things that have done in the past. I doubt very much the Chinese are inclined to consider how the Chinese state has persecuted racial minorities within its own borders, even now. Okay, so, but your point about what are the decolonizers, what do they envisage replacing the present? Well, I guess you're right. I mean, like all revolutionaries, they're very good at taking stuff down, not terribly good at putting stuff up, back up again. So it's not clear at all what they plan to replace it with. I guess they want to create a kind of radically egalitarian society, but I have to observe that their methods are aggressive and authoritarian. And you'll know as well as I that means corrupt ends. If you use aggressive authoritarian means, the chances are what you build afterwards will be aggressively authoritarian. So I don't hold up much hope for the survival of liberal culture. And indeed, it's been poisoned already. If the radical decolonizers, if the ultra-progressives prevail.
It does deeply sadden me at times in discourse, certainly even when I was in Parliament, that terrible paradox of, yes, people claiming what this country was. It's racist, broken, evil. And yet you're going, well, actually, we're not perfect, but compared to many other countries and nations, we're doing pretty well. But that absurdity, as I mentioned, says me that earlier, the absurdities, the lies need to be amplified to make sure that the narrative continues. And I don't know, there's an oddity that, and I think unfortunately it's coming through our universities in New Zealand and into our younger generation, a belief that our systems somehow are sort of a perversion of Rousseau, really, that this state of democracy and liberalism and freedom is just normal. And you're like, guys, this is unusual to have the freedoms we do.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And my worry is that recent generations have not been taught history in such a way as to appreciate that what we have was built at great cost over a long time, and what was built can be lost. Perhaps in due course, when youngsters come to appreciate the threat posed by Russia and China, they will realize what's at stake. I hope so.
I hope so too. Hey, look, I'm conscious of your time. So if I don't, one quick set of questions around this whole free speech side, and you hinted at the start, obviously you had begun this project, Ethics and Empire, a number of years ago, and the denunciation started. Can you just give us, or listeners, a quick appreciation of what that was like and why you chose to hold your ground? And kudos for that, because so many other academics, politicos and the like take the barrage and back away, but you've held the line. In fact, you've dug in, which is great.
So, Simon, in 2017, I launched a project in Oxford called Ethics and Empire. I did it in collaboration with a very eminent historian of empire, John Darwin. When that came to the attention of some academics in Cambridge and Oxford in early December, they launched a concerted campaign to shut down the project. There were three online denunciations published, mass denunciations, the last one signed by roughly 200 academics worldwide, calling upon my university to take the project out of my hands. It was very unnerving. I'd never experienced that kind of public aggression before, or that kind of aggression before, and I was quite shaken. My historian collaborator resigned from the project within 4 days of the first trouble brewing. I wondered whether the project might survive. One of my oldest friends told me to abandon the project because it was too toxic. When I didn't, he resigned from an advisory council of a center that I ran. So I was feeling beleaguered and confused. It was distressing. However, I came through it. I came through it. Why? Well, partly because my university, it was and still is basically liberal, and I was supported by people at the top. I did wonder whether I was daft in my views on colonialism, because I've made clear that I don't think that empire is illegitimate always and everywhere, which is, I think, what aroused the ire of my critics. I didn't wonder if I was daft, but I thought about it and I talked about it. And I thought, no, I think I'm right here. Besides, and I think I've reflected on what courage is, Simon, and I think at base, courage is simply that you love something so much and you care about something so much, you're not prepared to stay silent and see it trashed. I think that's it. It's basically love. No one aims to be courageous or brave. You just can't stand sitting around and not contradicting the nonsense around you. So that's what happened. That's what it felt like. And that's why I stood my ground. And I should say the other thing is, very early on, I got messages from people with non-white skins, Indian Britons, for example, saying, "We agree with you. We agree with you." So then I realized that actually there are people, there are the grandsons or even the sons of the subject of empire in India, for example, who agree with me. And the more I've been around, as I say, the more I think my nuanced view is actually perfectly, perfectly right.
And clearly it was a catalyst around the Free Speech Union in the UK. So you've become the chair, as I understand it, of the union. I suppose just the final question then, it flows from that is, and I know it's such a simple, almost a trite question, but why is it that free speech is so important? And in some ways, why at the heart of academia are you being attacked? As a segue, New Zealand had a situation a couple of years ago where several very esteemed professors, and I'm sure it's been told to you, made some commentary around science versus traditional belief. Long and short, about 2,000 academics and administrators in our university signed a letter to get them fired. And you're going, last time I checked, academia is about discussion and debate, not trying to cancel people. But yeah, well, why is free speech a valuable and important, I would argue, as I'm sure you would, fundamental right in our countries?
It's important in brief, Simon, because sometimes ideas prevail that are false. And if those ideas shape public policy, people are damaged. So the idea, for example, that you can change your gender at will, no matter what age you are, and you can receive puberty blockers that will cause irreversible effects on your body as a child, those ideas are unwise because children often don't quite know who they are. Many of us don't know who we are until we're quite adult. And certainly in Britain, there are kids who have undergone those sex changes who now regret it and they can't go back. We've discussed the radicalizing of race relations, the exacerbation of racial consciousness that some of these ideas produce. And we've talked about the demoralizing effect of this very black story about our colonial past. So these ideas have negative damaging effects. And if we're not free to challenge them, the lies win. We have to have a culture where it's permissible in the law to challenge false ideas. Otherwise, we all get damaged by it. And the good news from Britain is that in 4 years, since the foundation of the Free Speech Union, which now has 20,000 subscribing members, giving the FSU in the UK an annual income from subscriptions alone of about 2 million New Zealand dollars, and there are donations in addition to that. And the FSU is doing a great job in collaboration with the centre-right press of holding institutions to account, embarrassing them in public, and getting them to be accountable, and coming to the aid of beleaguered dissidents. And we helped to shape and promote a piece of legislation that was enacted last year, although it's currently being threatened by the new Labour government. So in 4 years, I want to say to folk, we've created institutions and laws that are already transforming the landscape.
Well, I think, well, first of all, I think it's fantastic. And I think it's actually a very hope-filled way to finish the interview. So, Professor, look, again, my thanks for actually all the time you've generously given in a wide range of topics, and wish you well for your tour and time here in New Zealand.
Thanks very much, Simon. I'm really delighted we've had a chance to speak because these matters are so important and it's good to have a thoughtful discussion about them. Thanks a lot.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.